Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate that everything, simply everything you could possibly think of, has its own history. Like pastry, flatulence, and bell bottoms.
Oh, I think we could sort of merge those together, couldn't we? Into one sort of, you know, Uber episode. Or we could do kings, rings and things, wings, strings and pings. Pings is all about the COVID crisis and being pinged, I think. However, that is to monstrously digress, which we don't want to do, because what we should be doing and what we will be doing is following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, who knew that the history of smugness is in fact all about toxic insults, contemporary politics, and the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID jab, the myth of the overconfident Icarus, he of the melting wings, depicted by Peter Bruegel the Elder as a pair of legs poking out of the sea, as well as about schadenfreude, the joy of having someone else's smugness punctured. It's also all about Napoleon, of course it is. It's about Nelson, Siegfried Sassoon's suicide in the trenches, and the horrors of trench warfare during World War One, and of course, the history of scrumping. Who knew? Or who knew that the history of rhyming, something I'm very fond of, is in fact all about the history of the singing game and the transmission of dance songs across the centuries to children's playgrounds. It's about Renaissance verse, Petrarchan sonnets, Thomas Wyatt and the court of Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn and World War One. It's also all about Edward Lear and nonsense, limericks and professional writing for a living. Who knew, Sam Willis?
I enjoyed that one. My favourite episodes, I think, have been the history of rhyming and the history of nonsense. Mm. The internet's favourite episodes are different. They are the history of the bottom and the history of cats.
Yes, I can imagine. Yeah, we should do more cats. More cats,
cats bottoms. Let's do cats bottoms. We can do that. You're probably wondering who's telling you all this wonderful stuff. Let me say of my fellow presenter that if he could take the past off a shelf, wrap it up and gift it to each and every one of you, he would. He is the Father Christmas of the past with a sack full of history, the bringer of good and unsolicited historical tidings, the man just waiting to donate to anyone wandering by with a hole in their knowledge like a missing piece of jigsaw. He is the gift giver extraordinaire at the forefront of the endowment of the present with the past. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's Professor James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. And once again, I'm completely lost on that, but it sounded brilliant.
Didn't it?
You may well be wondering, who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot this very episode? Well, let's just say that if he were a generosity-related historian, he'd only give you the scholarly shirt off his back, so keen is he to cure the poverty of knowledge of the past. He'd cast shekels far and wide, so full of zeal is he to enrich the world with knowledge of the past. So munificent is he that he would present the historical equivalents of gold, frankincense and myrrh as gifts to those bereft of an understanding of history. Yes, you've guessed it, it's your friend and mine, the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, everyone. Sam. Hello. And welcome to our episode on the history of generosity. It is the final part of our Christmas mini-series that we've been doing. James and I get very overexcited and do lots and lots of episodes this time of year. I particularly enjoyed our episode on babies and donkeys this year. James, what about you?
I liked the first one, the introduction to Christmas, because that gets us all thinking about all about Christmas. And I love talking about Charles Dickens and Christmas Carol. And that was really exciting. These incredibly valuable first editions of Christmas Carol being sold for tens of thousands of pounds. But for this one on generosity, I was inspired by something that I read in the newspaper this week. I don't know whether you saw this, but Lost Library of Literary Treasures saved for the UK after charity raises £15 million. This is, of course, about the Honresfeld Library, which had all sorts of rare manuscripts by famous, well-known writers, such as the Brontes, Jane Austen, Walter Scott, and there was fear that it would fall into private hands until the National Heritage Memorial Fund and a group of libraries got together and started raising money. And they raised enough money in order to save it. And one of the most generous people, I think this is Britain's wealthiest individual, a guy called Sir Leonard Blavatnik, he donated, I think, £4 million, something like that. He decided that he would match fund everything. And what it's meant is that all of these amazing things have been saved. And this was a collection that was assembled in the 19th century by a mill owner, one William Law. And it's been inaccessible for 80 years, and it's got all sorts of treasures in it. The charity that was leading this fundraising drive was the Friends of the National Libraries, and what they're going to do now is basically donate each of these works to various libraries around the country. So it's brilliant. And just to quote the Friends of the National Libraries, they thanked Blavatnik for his exceptional munificence and said that in recognition of his great generosity, there we are, the key word, the collection will be henceforth known as the Blavatnik Honresfeld Library. So there we are, Sam, an act of generosity in our time. There's a lovely quote from a friend of mine, Dr. Gabriel Heaton, who's at Sotheby's. He's a manuscript specialist there. Hello, Gabriel, if you're listening, which I imagine you're not. Like no other that has come to the market in recent decades, this collection, we were amazed and delighted at the incredible ambition of the Friends of National Libraries' plan to acquire the whole library, and they deserve every credit for bringing their campaign to a successful conclusion. Their success is a testament to what can be achieved by the collaboration of public institutions and private collectors. The other thing to mention is this generosity is not just by very wealthy individuals, but also by members of the public. And millions were raised by individuals donating small amounts from their hard-earned money in order to preserve this literary heritage.
Lovely
story.
Stuff. Great stuff to hear. Being generous does release endorphins. I read that the other day. Giving something of giving a gift, giving something of your time, whatever it be. Being generous, being charitable to people, physically makes you feel better. So there's a plenty good reason for us all to be doing it. And I think it's one of the reasons that everyone feels so good about themselves on Christmas Day. It's the joy of giving more so than the joy of receiving. I immediately thought of my favourite psychological experiment. I've become, through Histories of the Unexpected, become slightly obsessed with psychological experiments from the mid-20th century. This one is called The Ultimatum Game from the 80s. I think I've mentioned this before, but I couldn't remember in what episode. It's called The Ultimatum Game. It's absolutely fantastic. So you've got two people who are randomly matched, and one is a proposer, the other one is the responder. And what they do is they play a game, and they play it once. What happens is that the proposer is given a certain amount of money, And he or she suggests a division of that amount of money between him or herself and the other person. The other person then quite simply decides whether to accept or reject the offer. If the division of money is accepted, then they both keep that amount of money. But if rejected, then both the proposer and the responder earn nothing from the experiment. So say you've got £100, I would, you know, would I offer you, James, £50? And you know, do you accept that or do you not? And it's really interesting what it reveals about people. And most people offer between 40% and 50% of the actual amount of money, and that split is almost always accepted by the other side. But when it fails, that's when it goes down to about 20% of the endowment, and the receiver says, actually, sod you, I'm not going to accept that, and we will both have nothing. Anyway, a fascinating experiment which has been used to. What's interesting, you see, is if you enact that experiment with different cultures around the world, and you get different answers, and it's really helped us understand the history of bargaining and the history of people's relationship with money and generosity over time. So I wanted to mention that, James, and I'm going to go on and I'm going to talk about the Plantagenets and particularly Henry VI and maybe a bit of Romans.
Ooh, lovely. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about gift giving. We've talked about gift giving in the past. We've done a whole episode on gifts, but inspired by the Nativity and the three wise men, this is where we're coming from here, the gifts of gold, frankincense and myrrh. I'm interested in telling you a little bit about the tradition of gift giving at Christmas. And this is something that comes from the Bible and the three wise men, but also it's earlier than that. So gift giving was around in the ancient pre-Christian world. It then becomes associated with the Christian feast of Christmas. But in ancient Rome, it has always been part of the winter celebrations, the winter solstice in December, around the Saturnalia holiday. And there are various sort of gifts that would have been given at around this time. It starts off that early Christian rulers interpret the giving of gifts as subjects should give gifts to them rather than the other way round. And that, in fact, what we see is tributes going to people. Post-Reformation, though, I think there's a big shift and Christmas gift giving to superiors becomes much less common, and actually is transformed in terms of gift giving to children. And I think that's one of the many sort of shifts that we see. But this idea of gift giving indeed has a really early tradition. The clever archaeologists at English Heritage, who look after Stonehenge and various sort of sites associated with that, have seen Stonehenge as a site for feasting and gift exchanging to commemorate the end of the year and the beginning of the next. We talked about this when we talked about Christmas in our first Christmas episode, and we talked about mince pies there. But actually, in the excavations at Durrington Walls near Stonehenge, there were about 38,000 animal bones from pigs and a few cattle that survived, most of which would have been slaughtered around midwinter time. I think what is fascinating is the way in which we can trace the shift in gift-giving cultures across time. If we think about medieval gift traditions, we can see this in various places, different sort of gifts that were given and connected to particular abbeys, for example. And there was an abbey where there was a tradition of giving relics to people. There are also, if we look at the Tudor period, there is a spate of competitive gift giving. And we've talked in the past about the Elizabethan gift rolls being these incredible documents that record all the gifts that would have been given to the monarch on New Year's and the gifts that were given back. But I want to give you some examples from slightly earlier in the Tudor period. Again, exchanged at New Year. And these are gifts exchanged between Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. Get these for generous gifts. So in New Year 1532, Anne Boleyn gave Henry VIII, and I quote, an exotic set of richly decorated Pyrenean boar spears. And Henry gave Anne hangings of cloth of gold, cloth of silver, and embroidered crimson satin for her room and bed. And the king, this is telling, refused to accept the gift of a gold cup sent to him by his wife at the time, Catherine of Aragon. So gift-giving there actually gets you right to the heart of the relationship between Henry and Anne Boleyn and how he was feeling towards Catherine of Aragon. New Year 1533, from Henry to Anne. This is what Henry VIII gave Anne Boleyn. Parcels of gilt plate, late of Sir Henry Guildford, controller of the household. Two gilt pots with round knobs behind the lids, which came to Sir Henry as executor to Sir William Compton, weighing 133 ounces. That heavy, very valuable. A pair of gilt flagons with the arms of France, 147 ounces. Six gilt bowls with a cover, 200.5 ounces. Six gilt salts with a cover of pears, touch, which belonged to Sir William Compton, 77 ounces. 12 gilt spoons with demi-knots at the end, weighing 11 ounces. A pair of parcel gilt pots, 99.5 ounces. Another, 97.75 ounces. Another, 71 ounces. Six parcel gilt bowls with cover, 199.25 ounces, and so it goes on. Four candles, white, with high sockets, 86.5 ounces. A round basin of silver for a chamber and a silver pot to the same, weighing 138.5 ounces. And a chafing dish parcel, gilt, 39.75 ounces. So there's this incredibly generous, lavished gift-giving. In New Year 1534, from Anne Boleyn to Henry, a goodly gilt basin having a rail or board of gold in the midst of the brim, garnished with rubies and pearls, wherein standeth a fountain, also having a rail of gold about it, garnished with diamonds. Out thereof issueth water at the teats of three naked women standing at the foot of the same fountain. Now, of course, this is very highly elevated, wealthy, royal individuals, but also ordinary people exchanged gifts as well. You'd often, this is where gloves come in, you'd often have the gifts put in inside gloves. Glove money would be given to servants at this time. Oranges, cloves, those kinds of things. You know, just as much as the wise men might have given gold and sort of rich spices. And I think one of the things that we see also is a shift in practices from the medieval to the modern, not only in terms of timing, but also in terms of who the gifts are given to. If you think about Christmas Day, very broadly, traditionally it was marked by feasting, wassailing, and generally, you know, pretty sort of loud, raucous, antisocial behaviour. Bands of young men would go from door to door singing carols, drinking from a wassail bowl, and getting gifts in return. What happens, though, is that this emphasis here is upon adults rather than children. And with the advent of Father Christmas, as the sort of master of ceremonies for, you know, gift giving to children, things shift from adults towards children and the family. And this is something that we see shifting in the Victorian period, when Christmas becomes a time for family celebrations, with the emphasis on gifts to children and the Christmas in the home surrounded by the family. And so this gift giving also shifts not only from the from adults to children and the family, but also the date shifts from early December or New Year to actually Christmas, either Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. And there are various sort of different traditions that people might have had. So here we are. I've got you that example of the medieval gift giving. There is a list of accounts at Battle Abbey from the 13th through to the early 16th century, and it records things spent on Christmas presents for the monastery's servants. And there's a medieval manuscript listing relics once housed at Battle Abbey in East Sussex that basically shows festive gifts bestowed by William the Conqueror and holy offerings by King John. And dating from the mid-15th century, it lists 30 or so relic inventories that were given. Okay, and it seasonal highlights include relics from the ground where Christ was born, relics from the manger, relics from the crib, relics from the swaddling, relics from the bed the Virgin was lying in when he was born, a hair shirt and finger bone of St. Nicholas, obtained by the battle monks themselves, possibly in 1089, when the saint's relics were moved to a shrine in Italy, stones used to stone St. Stephen. His feast day is the 26th of December,
wow,
or Boxing Day. I know. Relics of several holy innocents killed on the orders of King Herod, which is a feast on the 28th of December, thought to have been part of William the Conqueror's gift. So, you know, that quite extraordinary gift giving. And we can follow this all the way through to the whirlwind of consumption and Black Friday and everything that is associated with gift giving nowadays. And the amount of money that is spent each year is extraordinary. I think I read somewhere that, you know, annually at around this time of year, it's billions of dollars are spent in the US as people buy presents for each other.
Mm. I love that list, especially with the Tudors. Was it boar spears that,
yes,
Anne Boleyn gave? Right, so how did she buy them? Did she have any money herself? I don't know anything about... I suppose the point is it raises the question of where Anne Boleyn got her money from, and also where she got the boar spears from. So, how does that actually work? She can't go onto her phone and go boar spears on Amazon. So do you reckon someone came to her with the boar spears and said, I think these would make a wonderful gift for the king? She said yes. Or do you think she said, I really want to get Henry a set of boar spears, and then said that to her man, who then went to Norway, wherever they came from. Where do they come from? Germany or something?
Pyrenean.
Pyrenean, sorry. Okay, yes. Spanish.
So I think, if you think about her, she is an aristocratic daughter. Her father is very well connected at court. Court is the centre of culture. Chivalric culture, so this sort of knightly culture, is really at its apogee during the reign of Henry VIII. It's something that he is deeply keen on. You know, he's constantly fighting personally in tourneys and tournaments and mock battles. And so she's actually buying him something that he'd really like. And my guess is that there are armourers at court who would be, you know, she would absolutely know about. And this is actually not just a generous gift, but it's also a gift that she knows, you know, the braggadocious Tudor monarch would love.
Yeah.
But I don't know is the true answer. I've just sort of, talked about that.
And I also love the fact of giving relics. Mm. I've never heard of giving stones used at the stoning. That's amazing. It kind of links onto what I was going to talk about, which is, and it's a similar period actually, but I want to talk about Henry VI. So this is the chaotic period before.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with purchase.
The Tudors come in, you know, pre-Wars of the Roses and all of that. Because he was incredibly generous. He was too generous, and he got himself in a right heap of trouble by giving away loads and loads of stuff, particularly land, because land is one of the sources that royalty gets their income from. And Henry just gave away so much land that it was reclaimed by something called the Acts of Resumption, which are very important. But it sought to undo all of the bad things Henry VI had done when he finally got into power himself. Anyway, one of the things he gave away were some relics, including believed to be a part of the True Cross and the Crown of Thorns, and he gave them to Eton College. Now, Henry VI's history is really interesting, because not only was he generous in giving away to his friends and people in court huge tracts of land, but he was also very generous to the youth of England. What he wanted to do was to invest in education. It was a major part of what Henry believed in. And he endowed Eton College and also King's College in Cambridge. And it was designed to be the next step up on. So the students would go to Eton College, then from there they would go on to King's in Cambridge. Now, when he endowed Eton College, he gave it a huge amount of land, and really, really valuable land. This is a list of all of the people. There's a list of the Feoffees. I don't actually know how to pronounce that.
Feoffees,
thank you, James. It's a list of the Feoffees appointed by the king to receive forfeited lands for the alien priories for the endowment of Eton. So the Archbishop of Chichel, I've never heard of that either, Bishop Stafford, Bishop Lowe, Bishop Ayscough, William de la Pole, Thomas Beckington, Richard Andrew, Adam Mullins, John Hampton, James Fiennes, William Tresham, all of these people owned immense amounts of land, which had actually already been given to them by Henry VI, a lot of them, as extra gifts. And then in turn, they were passed on to Eton College, along with a handful of relics, including the True Cross and the Crown of Thorns, and also a collection of some of England's most important medieval manuscripts, something that was known as the Apocalypse manuscripts. Now, Henry does get into immense trouble with all of this by simply giving away too much, and they try and recover it all through the acts of resumption later on in the 1570. And also a lot of the grants given to Eton were annulled when Edward IV becomes king in 1461. And a lot of the assets and the treasures, everything that had been sort of generously given from the hands of the king, from royal control to Eton College, were then taken back into royal control. And a lot of those assets and treasures and relics and whatever might be, and all the land as well, was taken to Windsor, and it was brought back under royal control. So in terms of royal generosity, Henry VI really is one of the most interesting characters you could possibly come across, because you see how very vividly, differently people think about what the king should be giving away, what he should control, because of what happens after the end of Henry VI's reign, and then the new reign of Edward IV.
Oh, Sam, that sounds very festive for us. Now, I wanted to go back to where I started at the beginning with my example of saving manuscripts for the nation. And I wanted to think about generosity in terms of philanthropy and giving things. And I wanted to talk in particular about the founding of the Folger Shakespeare Library, which is one of the world's best and greatest collections of material, books, manuscripts relating to Shakespeare. And I'm going to talk about this for a little bit now. And it was founded by Henry Clay Folger and his wife Emily Jordan Folger. And he was a wealthy industrialist. So he was born in New York on the 18th of June, 1857. And he went to work in the oil industry and for Standard Oil. And he goes along there and he learns the oil business. He receives a law degree from Columbia University, master's degree from Amherst. He marries Emily Jordan, who becomes his wife in 1885, and she is really pivotal in helping him fulfill his lifetime project of collecting everything, all materials by associated with Shakespeare. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, about what that collecting was, in a little bit. He basically, in 1911, there's an antitrust breakup of Standard Oil. He becomes president of Standard Oil Company of New York. It later becomes Mobil Oil. And he's given an honorary doctorate for efforts of collecting Shakespeare by Amherst College. He becomes the chairman of the board of Standard Oil of New York in 1923. He retires in March 1928 and devotes himself full time to plans for the Folger Shakespeare Library. Dies in 1930. They've identified where the Shakespeare Library was going to be built, but the building and the sort of first stone has been laid, but it's not actually opened before he dies. But it's all of this oil money that then gets put very generously to other purposes to build up a massive collection and bequeath it to the nation. But also key is not just Folger himself, but also his wife, Emily Jordan Folger. She was born on the 15th of May, 1855. Her father was a lawyer, newspaper editor during the Lincoln and Johnson administrations. He's a solicitor of the Treasury Department in Washington, D.C. Her mother was Mary Augusta Jordan, was a professor at Smith College from 1884 to 1921. Emily Jordan goes to Vassar, which is an all-women's college at that time, in 1879. She is herself a renowned scholar. And it's this sort of expertise that she has that allows her to help her husband with growing his Shakespeare collection and keeping up-to-date records of the contents of the collection. And the two of them sort of review auction house catalogues for possible acquisitions. And she's the one that advises him on these purchases. And she writes a master's degree at Vassar the title of which is On the True Text of Shakespeare. So she's really quite sort of, quite knowledgeable and experienced. Now, what's fascinating is the amount of collecting that they did, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But they find a venue for the Shakespeare Library, and they spent some years sort of scouting around for various places. They're obviously being wooed by places like Amherst and Vassar, with the hope that that the library would go there. And there are some potential sites at Amherst College in New York, Stratford-upon-Avon. But what they decide is that they are going to build it near the Capitol in Washington, D.C., after they basically discover this site that they'd like to build it on after traveling from travelling by train and coming out at Union Station and spending some time there. And then what he does is, this was a sort of a normal street with a row of townhouses, and over a 9-year period, having decided this is where it wants to go, he buys up the entire row, known as Grant's Row, and then has them demolished before the library is constructed. And as I said, he dies before it sort of comes, before it's actually opened. But you know, he is able to have secured the place for it. Building's been started. They hire a group of architects to do it. There's an Elizabethan theatre there that's placed at the east end of the building. It's a couple of blocks from the Capitol building. It's absolutely amazing. I spent a couple of years there, and it is one of the most extraordinary places for early modern scholarship. And particularly if you're interested in Shakespeare, it's the place to go to. And I'll just give you a sense of what they collected, because it has 260,000 printed books, 60,000 manuscripts, 90,000 prints, drawings, photographs and paintings, and also something like 250,000 playbills relating to films, recordings and stage costumes. So it is incredible, absolutely incredible. Now, let me just give you a sense of the Shakespeare collection alone. The Shakespeare collection includes 178 early modern quarto editions of Shakespeare's plays and poems.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. So the quartos are those little... you think of the first folio, which is the sort of, you know, the collected works. These little quartos are small and inexpensive books that would have been... Yeah, it would have been used in Shakespeare's lifetime. So they have almost 200 of them. They are really rare. They are sometimes the only known survivals. They've got, for example, a first edition of Titus Andronicus. They also collect multiple copies, because what they're interested in studying the printing history, but also copies that have annotations in them, because then you can actually start studying how people read and sort of interpreted Shakespeare. In addition to those quartos, and this is the most impressive, have you ever seen a first folio?
No.
I mean, it's huge. Imagine like a big Bible.
Oh,
it's
right,
a
yeah.
really impressive book. They have 82 copies of the 1623 first folio. So this is the first collected edition of the plays. They also hold 58 copies of the second folio, 1632, and 23 copies of the third folio, 1663 to 64, and 38 copies of the fourth folio, printed in 1685. I once got taken down into the stacks to have a look at their collection, and I've seen the wall of these editions, and it is probably the most impressed I have ever been in a library. I literally had to sort of, my jaw dropped as I saw it. They also have continental books. They have 35,000 early modern printed books from the European continent. And what's more, it also has an incredible secondary literature section. I mean, it's a voluminous library. So there we are. And all of this is upon the generosity of Folger himself. And what's fascinating is thinking about how they collected themselves. This is a husband and wife who were just obsessed with it and had the wherewithal and the resource, the experience, the learning to go out and find all these things. And I remember talking to some of the people who'd worked there. And there was a period where, after the Second World War, and Britain wasn't, you know, was in sort of a phase of rebuilding, and a lot of things were coming onto the market, and you know, the people who worked at the Folger were just given checkbooks and could come across and just tour around the second-hand, you know, antiquarian bookshops and just hoovered up all sorts of things. I mean, Folger used to go to auctions anonymously and use second parties, third parties, to actually bid for him so that he wasn't sort of fleeced for them. And so they've just, you know, put together this amazing, generous collection.
Makes you think about what the motivation for generosity, doesn't it? I suppose the Folgers, what, they were being generous to themselves first? Is that what you do when you're a collector? Are you generous to yourself?
I think the idea is that you want to collect and then bequeath.
Nevertheless, I think motivation for generosity is
obsession,
really interesting.
I think.
And yes, that's another good point. Another reason for that kind of collection is that you can't stop. Looking at the Romans, Roman charity is very interesting because it really does highlight the issue of motivation for generosity. And particularly in Rome, you couldn't really get any public support. I mean, without lavishing something entertaining or generous with your own personal money onto the public. There was no public life without generosity, and the opposite of that is that miserliness, of course, was scorned. One of the most interesting examples, and we write about this in our Histories of the Unexpected, the Romans, in the chapter on taming wild animals, the games put on by Brutus in 44. And so this is the spring of 44. Brutus, of course, is one of the leading conspirators in the assassination of Caesar. And what happens in the aftermath of that is that a lot of the conspirators are forced into exile. Brutus himself goes to Crete, but he retains a rank, a really important rank, called Praetor Urbanus, because that allows him... He's a senior magistrate of Rome. It allows him to put on games. So it allows him to buy back into public popular opinion. And he doesn't just put on games from distant Crete. He puts on an enormous... games, and it's particularly noticeable for sourcing a huge number of exotic animals for the arena. In fact, interestingly, his games were scheduled first for that summer, and tellingly, in one of the few documents that survives relating to it, he orders all of his agents to use every single wild animal in his games, because the next person who's coming is Octavian. It's Octavian. So that's Caesar's adopted heir, Octavian. He has some games after Brutus, and Brutus makes sure that there aren't any wild animals left to see in the arena. But there's a fascinating history of charity in Rome and how it changes. There's a particularly interesting chapter on, I think, for us, having gone through COVID, on furlough schemes or on government support, whatever that might be, whether it's in finance or in Roman times, in terms of grain. So they had something called the grain dole. It started off in 123 BC, and by 62 BC, they were handing out subsidised grain to something around 320,000 people. I thought it was a really powerful statistic to give you a sense of the power and the reach of the Roman Empire. And it wasn't just grain. And once they started with grain, they moved on to bread and olive oil and wine and pork, James. So I thought they're probably some of my favourite things in the whole world. And so the government, rather than giving you money on furlough, if you were Roman living during the period of something like 193 to 211 AD, during the reign of Septimius Severus, you could have a roast dinner.
I think I could,
on behalf of the Roman state.
I think I could survive on olive oil, wine and pork. Pork of various
bread,
types.
And bread. It as well.
Goodness me. What more could you want?
I know.
Well, I just wanted to end with just some expensive gifts that people have given. Since it's the festive season, those of you thinking about giving gifts to your loved ones, just listen to these. One of the most expensive gifts that was given is the jewel in the crown. The last Maharaja of the Sikh Empire, Duleep Singh, presented to Queen Victoria a 186-carat Kohinoor diamond in 1849. This is a huge diamond, and it needed to be cut down to 105.6 carats, and it's set in the crown, and it's the sort of one of the highlights of the British crown jewels. And just to give you an estimate of its value, By comparison, the Hope Diamond, which is less than half its size at 45.42 carats, is estimated to be worth in excess of $250 million. So it's that's quite a thing. And when you're thinking of buying something for your wife, Sam, I think of in 1917, the New York banker Morton Plank traded his six-story Fifth Avenue mansion for a $1 million pearl necklace from Cartier as a gift for his young wife, estimated at around $20 million today. Or think of the cosmetics billionaire Leonard Lauder, who in 2003 gave his $1.1 billion collection of Cubist masterpieces to New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. Or think of, I don't know whether you've heard of this, but Rod Stewart wanted to exchange Christmas gifts with Elton John, and he thought that he would buy him a top-of-the-range, swanky, portable refrigerator that was all singing, all dancing. So he turns up, gives this to Elton, and Elton, in return, hands him a package. He opens it up, and it is a Rembrandt painting. How stupid did he feel? So then, apparently, in 1990, when Rod Stewart was marrying Rachel Hunter, Elton apparently sent him a gift certificate worth about £15 from Boots, the chemist, the British chemists, enclosed with a note: "Get yourself something nice for the house."
Nice, very good, very good,
brilliant.
Good bit of banter there between two of our most loved musicians. Yes. Guys, thank you all so much for listening to our episode on generosity. I hope you've enjoyed it. I also hope you've really enjoyed our mini Christmas series. James and I have hugely enjoyed putting them together. If you want to find out what's coming up in the new year, please follow me on Twitter at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're interested in the history of the sea and ships, do please listen to my other podcast, the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And you can follow me on Twitter at James Daybell. You can follow the podcast at Unexpected Pod. We are also all over social media. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, so check us out there. And a big shout out at Christmas to James Cooper, who runs a wonderful website. So Google him up, check him out. It's a history of Christmas, all sorts of interesting Christmas facts for you there. You can also check out our website, historiesoftheunexpected.com, for all our back catalogue, including all our previous year's Christmas episodes. If you've enjoyed this little series that we've done for you, you can also get signed books for the new year, which is a brilliant way to start off. A New Year's resolution: read more history, read James and Sam. That's what you should be saying to yourself. And if you would like to be a patron, head over to patreon.com, and anything that you can give to help support us change the way in which people think about the past would be very much appreciated. But meanwhile, happy festive season wherever you are. Hope that you are safe and well and enjoying yourselves. Take care, everyone.
Cheerio, guys. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.